humor, a very straight way of putting out some very funny lines. And at one point he started talking about the work they were going to have to do to set up checkpoints, and we need to set up a system whereby people will have to register if they're non-Indians, and we're going to register all firearms. And he said, we're going to have to be particularly careful with white people who come in, and because we have to give them probably complete physical exams. We don't want any of their diseases coming in here. It was good spirit. There were a lot of whites there, and I think it was the way it was presented was very, very good.
How serious are they in regard to their manifesto that they have seceded from the Union? Is this to bring up the meaning of that they to advance the importance of the treaty arrangement? To sort of point up in people's minds, after all, they were made by an independent nation originally.
I guess.
Is this to dramatize the present situation, or are they honestly serious in attempting to drive the interpretation? I wouldn't think so.
I think it's both in a way. I get the feeling that these guys are willing to die for the benefit of Indians in the country. And, you know, if they're willing to put down their lives, if by dissolving the independent nation they could do something about the Indian cause, I think that they would put that down too, you know, subordinating it to something of benefit to more people than themselves. But I think they're absolutely serious. In fact, I think that this thing's going to be tied up in the courts probably the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they have a very clear basis for being an independent nation. And not a secession, so to speak, but, you know, the almost a re-recognition of, you know, the independent nation.
Of course, the Aquasassanis still can go abroad on their own passports. They are accepted and they do go.
Who's this?
The Mohawks at St. Regis.
Yeah.
And the Seminoles, I met one Seminole who was a guard, told me that when he joined the Marines, he had to sign a waiver of his rights as a Seminole, and had to sign a similar one when he went overseas, because they never were defeated.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to answer your question. Ideally, I would have liked to have had an opportunity to really sit down as a person committed to, you know, nonviolent struggle and get to know some individuals like Russell Means, just to really feel them out on some things.
Probably you can as time goes on.
I would hope so. It wasn't possible this week.
No, it's a little traumatic.
We had opportunities to get some glimpses of their program and who get some feeling for who they are. And I'm impressed, frankly. When the ultimatum came down Wednesday, I don't think we shared with you that there at that point the NCC people had pretty good access in and out. And Bill Moyer and Bernard had an experience that I'd like to share with you. They were, before the deadline had come, were speaking with some of the leadership. I don't know if it was Russell or Dennis, who it was. But it's interesting, the question that they asked Bill, you would expect maybe, how's it looking out there, and do you think they're really going to come in? What can you do to maybe diffuse the situation? The question was, when do you think they're going to come in to kill us? And to my mind, that's a profound question. It moves things to a different level. It says something about commitment to struggle and preparation for the worst. Whether someone can be prepared for that, I don't know. But I think it says something that I think the press has missed from my monitoring of news for a few days before going. I really sensed in a lot of the TV network people a feeling that it was a play, it was a game. It's no game. I think that's one thing that comes through to me very clearly. It's no game at all. There are people there who are committed with their lives, and Bidge is quite right. Some of them are going to be tangled up in courts and in a lot of ways, prisons perhaps, for a good portion of their lives. I think we need to recognize that as we look ahead to ways in which we can be supportive and find room to move in this whole field.
A couple of questions.
Has
either one of you heard of a community relations staff meeting the other day? There was mention of some people calling to meet with me from Denver and who were stopped apparently by FBI agents under the provisions of the Anti-Riot Act. Yeah. And I just wondered if that's been happening more or whether there's any indication that we're moving.
Yeah, a little bit.
From California, too.
Yeah. One thing we were seeing a lot of, I hope the legal thing can really be pursued, because I think there's a lot of stuff that needs to be dealt with. I've been sort of working in criminal justice field now for a few years, and some of the stuff they were doing just at the checkpoints coming in and out, the FBI, when a lot of people were trying to get out on Tuesday, Wednesday, when it was possible for some to get out, when it was not possible for anyone to get in, they were arresting people, saying you're under arrest, in some cases putting people into handcuffs.
Those wire things.
Yeah, worse. Reading Miranda, you don't have to say anything, then taking people aside in very deep, thorough interrogation, at which point they'd load people up and take them into the BIA building in Pine Ridge and cut them loose. You're free to go. Essentially using arrest as a way of interrogation and getting intelligence on what's going on inside. FBI, very blatant. I think the stuff you're talking about from people coming from out of state, the great efforts to keep track of anyone that looks militant, as they put it. You know.
The rest of people are coming from California.
No telling how many people now have been.
Well, can they do that? I mean,
well, they're doing it.
Is it an offense to just move along the road?
They won't give their names or badge numbers either.
One
FBI agent who told me to leave an area wouldn't give me his name or badge number. And he said, see, he's got a badge on. That's good enough, pointing to another man. And he went somewhere and came back. And I said, well, listen, Mr. Saron, I really want to talk to you. He said, how do you know my name? Really shocked as well. But it was on a piece of tape on his M16. And this sort of broke down his resistance a little bit. Yeah, I said, it's on your guys.
You could read it.
But I met him later and had a nice talk with him last Saturday. But anyway, they were just not acting legally, but they will justify it by the emergency nature of the thing. Something else on that list. Oh, on the same Saturday, they got after me because I mentioned a woman who came out with government permission because she was expecting a child that day or the next. They agreed that a medic and her husband could accompany her and not be subject to arrest, but the men would be subject to search, which they agreed on. But when we got out, they held the men for a while for questioning before they would let them out and let her go on with the doctor. Well, I was leaning into the car where the young Indian man was, and I don't know whether he asked me directly or indirectly, but I know I said that, you'll be advised of your rights to remain silent, to have counsel present, and, you know, that you're under there's no condition that you have to say anything in order for you to go out by the agreement that we had. And I told him that. Well, when the FBI found out that I had said this to them, they really got after the agent in charge for simply telling him what his
rights
were. Not even telling him what his rights were, but telling him what they were going to say to him. I didn't know if he could read English or speak English or understand the paper that they would give him. And then he refused to say anything to him whatsoever. And finally, you know, then I go to the hospital. But they were really upset about that.
You know, it's very rough, and
oh my.
It's not a question of what's legal, it's a question of what they're doing.
You know, this sort of action is dictated from above. It isn't something that's assumed by an individual because it is the boss on that particular job. Isn't this standard procedure?
Well, Harper Wood was in charge, and some of the agents were hostile to his approach to it. And I think they would have provoked something if they could.
Mm-hmm.
Like just the tactical thing that this car going after the van, the exchange of gunfire, it was just absurd in that situation to try to stop a potentially stunned van. It could never have left the area anyway.
Oh my.
So that's
nightmares repeat themselves.
It's just too bad that that the FBI and the CIA and the rest of the alphabet soup are trying to run everything by old Mission Impossible scripts.
The problem is,
just what's happened.
One of the things that increases the hostility is that the Indians are able to play by the same script a little bit better. They've captured 6 or 7 FBI agents, taking their guns and deporting them, much to the embarrassment of the FBI agents.
This is Reverend Amos Johnson, who's chairman of our Coalition on Indian Affairs.
Sure, we met before. He's
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ben
Deming.
Nice to meet you.
They've been out by me.
Ms. Harding, one would appreciate any reaction to that. Written for the WIL.
Occasionally, I meet people who refer to as bended knee.
Bended knee, yes. Maybe that's
I
a good one.
I straighten them up.
I wanted to mention one thing.
Mr. Wood from the deputy attorney general was open to that. John Adams spent a great deal of time setting up the logistics. A great deal of hesitance among marshals to allow Mr. Wood to go. They had great fear for his safety, at least they expressed it. And they kept asking John, can you promise that nothing will happen? And John said, no, I can't, but I'm going to do everything in my power that it won't, and I don't believe it will. And they finally opened the way. They went in. They arrived at the Indian checkpoint. And as John described it, at that point, everything, he just sort of felt the bottom fall out. There was a row of Indian security people there. There were two burned cars that were sort of tipped on side across the road, and the idea is that you had to drive down the shoulder and around them and up again as part of the Indian checkpoint. And they were asked to get out of their cars. They said, get out of the car right here. And John described getting out of the car with Mr. Wood, and they walked down a little bit of a gully and up again, and he felt great relief because on the other side, almost like you're crossing the border, here were the Indian leadership, Russell Means, Dennis Banks, and so forth. And what he described, I think, was ingenious as he described it, because essentially they had to walk together, Mr. Wood from Justice Department, Indian leadership, for that roughly quarter of a mile, maybe, to the place where they met. And by walking together and talking and sort of the informal sort of thing as they moved, a certain rapport began to take place. And John described it as, he said it wasn't just accidental that they did it that way. It was very ingenious. They had a chance to see, it relieved Mr. Wood of a great deal of his anxieties. It got him loosened up. It got them sort of talking on some informal levels before they started. I think that's the sort of thing that this leadership is capable of. A great deal of know-how and a great deal of courage.
I think it was Russell said Mr. Wood was talking about the Indians originally having come from Mongolia across the land bridge. And he said, well, he didn't subscribe to that theory, but then when the indictments came down, he sure wished he'd be in Mongolia.
Yeah. That kind of give and take, which really loosened things up. A lot of humor.
And then after their negotiations, they've been invited to dinner. Yeah. And
someone said, this is the best meal we've had in a while. They pull out the best food for the occasion.
Well, we certainly are most appreciative when you come. I hope that worked out for you to come to the other meeting.
Well, I just want to say that I have a great deal of respect for the Indian Committee, and I only regret that I didn't have a chance to touch base with the committee in a full way before leaving. I know Bitch feels this too. It was certainly my action was, it kind of grew out of a deep personal concern. I don't feel I went as a yearly meeting representative or representative of the committee. I just happen to have a lot of respect for some of the people who were there and whom I worked with on other projects. And when the call came down, come, I have enough respect for them to pull it up and go. So I just appreciate having a chance to meet with you folks. And if you see some way we can be helpful to your work as a committee, I for one am willing to pitch in and be of any help I can.
Yeah. Have they spoken to you about coming to your meeting?
No. Friday afternoon.
It will be Friday afternoon.
This Friday.
This first Friday.
Friday.
This Friday.
This Friday.
Good.
Good.
I can come. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's a four.
Incidentally.
I don't know. I knew they were going to try to bring
it. I want to report this. That there will probably be a radio show on WUHY. I think it's Saturday night. David Freudberg has it, which will be interviewing perhaps at least some of the people who were observers. And then Sunday night on Bill Larmer's show on the subject of religion, Julie Laughlin May and Jim Schrock, who were observers from this area, will be on that.
Good. That's Sunday night. And
at 9:30 on WCAU, 12:10. And that's a talk show where you can call in and comment.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I've listened to that sometimes.
Yeah. Have that again?
What's the station?
WCAU 1210, right after the hockey game. See which takes
and Saturday place. Nights is the educational?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the time.
Radio or TV?
Educational radio.
And also this evening at 11:30, Dick Cabot is doing 90 minutes on Wounded Knee. So yes.
90 minutes.
For you that like to stay up late.
That Channel 6.
Channel 6, right. He's going to have a very good program.
I will say, would someone like to... Can you use these like for display at yearly meetings?
Oh,
if
that would be
if somebody
good.
Take charge of them,
yeah. A bit more. Basically, I went out a week ago, the day after the ultimatum came down that they had to be out that Thursday, and I went out Friday, early Saturday morning, Saturday a week ago, and spent a week there. And during the week, I spent sort of my time with the National Council of Churches observer effort, which was housed in an Episcopal church, Pine Ridge, which is about 10 miles from Wounded Knee. We were there at the invitation of Bishop Armstrong of that that area, and specifically of the church they housed us. We had, during the week, I guess about midweek, we had maybe 40 people in our observer team. We spent a lot of time just training people. And on 2 days that I was there, we had specific teams out at checkpoints, roughly a dozen people to a shift, four cars, roughly. To just be there, to be taking some notes, to be on top of what was happening, to play what we considered to be an impartial role, standing between government and American Indian Movement. It's hard to know how to sum the week up, except that it was a real, believe me, a real learning experience. I have a great deal of respect for that movement. I support it, and I do so as someone committed to nonviolent struggle. I'm a pacifist, and yet, to my mind, it's a profound awakening of people. They're advocating the right things. They're asking for, I think, what this committee and others concerned about American Indian affairs ought to be, supporting. It was, I don't know how to sum up the week, except to say that we learned a great deal. We had, on 3 days, we had an opportunity to be in Wounded Knee. The weekend was pretty, things were pretty open. That's not this past weekend, the week before. There was a real feeling that it was over, that they sort of reached some agreements. The checkpoints were down. The government was doing a a Nixon low-profile thing. They were out of sight. We had hopes that they were leaving, doing what they ought to do. By Sunday, there was just a pouring in of many, many people. It was extremely interesting. People from out of state, out of country, many, many cars from places like Saskatchewan, British Columbia, West Coast, Oklahoma. It was just really interesting talking with people. I felt a great deal of openness to talk. During the afternoon on Sunday, there was the what Russell Means called an historic announcement in which they claimed their independence from the United States, and a great deal of support from people there for that whole approach. Someone termed it an Indian Woodstock. It was a very colorful and celebrative occasion in a very traditional Indian way. Many, many songs, dancing, drums. It was beautiful. By Monday, things were tense again with the rumors of... the first rumor was, I heard the ABC man confront Russell Means. He said, did you know that an FBI agent is in critical condition in the hospital? And Russell played it very well and said he'd had some reports of an incident, but he thought it was not that serious, and it was not. It was a superficial wound on above a hand. But it created a new climate, and we were very fearful. By Monday, that's a week ago this Monday, that things were really going to get hot again, and they did. By Monday evening, FBI and marshals and military hardware was rumbling along, and seemingly it had come out of the ground. I don't know where it was. It hadn't been present the day before. By Tuesday at 5, the roads in were sealed off, and there was no more access to Wounded Knee for our observers for the week. We had, at that time, already posted 11 or 12 people, and so during the next couple of days, we were out of communication, basically, with our people. Some of them stayed for about 24 hours. One person stayed till Thursday and came back with a lot of, I think, very interesting insights into what was happening there. Most of our role for the rest of the week was sort of maintaining a base operation for communication with both the government and the American Indian Movement, which meant car radio and base radio and walkie-talkies and a lot of phoning into the White House directly. Even the key person in charge of setting up negotiations is John Adams, who is a Methodist from Washington on special leave to work with the National Council of Churches. He's a very effective person. He works very hard, and he works everybody with him very hard. The first morning he arrived, he got us all up at 4 a.m. for a meeting, and by 6 we'd had our second meeting, by 7 we had our third, and people were off and running doing lots of things, a shuttle to Rapid City to bring in people, setting up a phone system, monitoring news, buying food and finding ways to... by this time the blizzard had hit. Tuesday we were... I was brought up in the Midwest, and I guess I'd forgotten how bad snowstorms are and how it sort of, in a sense, can tie people together. And I think it was essentially a very helpful thing that we had a blizzard. It united many, many people around the country. Lots of calls, concern about food, medicine, shelter. These things were real, and the government began to yield very quickly to John Adams' pressure to open up roads to getting food and medicine in. And there's been a trickle and now a pretty good system of getting that sort of stuff in. We played some role in getting that going. Maybe I've said enough.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Let me ask you one question. Is John Adams a black guy?
No, he's white.
I thought it was some guy in my
Yeah,
life.
His first time I met him, all I know is that he's done a lot of this type of emergency work. He worked with the team at Kent State. He did the observer work at the two conventions, Republican and Democrat in Miami. actually, he was called, he was on his way to Cairo, Illinois on Monday, and he was called and rerouted and pulled out of that for the duration of this. But he's considered their one of their kind of top people in these delicate situations in which people's lives are at stake.
Okay, thanks for this report. Hopefully you'll be able to stick around when the meeting's over.
Yeah,
I'm sure there'll be a number of questions that people have for
you. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. We now have a what I hope is a firm date, April 23rd.
Yes.
I apologize. That's awesome.
I guess we're all aware that's the day after Easter. Monday, Easter
Monday.
We have a little over $4,200. He didn't give me a breakdown.
That might be enough, might it?
Well, we figured, we originally said we'd work toward 5,000. And of course, Six Nations Brothers has a fund also.
New York Yearly Meeting has another fund, doesn't it?
Yes, and they put Syracuse Monthly Meeting has been helping. They've gotten acquainted. When Dina was down here for the last meeting, she told us that they were being cooperative, and we had a letter which we meant to bring in today from that meeting. I guess we didn't get it in, but they've started a fund. Syracuse gave $100, and they've sent a notice around to all the other New York meetings asking that they contribute, and I think they'll send their funds right into the Six Nations Brothers.
Does anyone know what the fund of the Six Nations Brothers directly is?
Oh, no, they had about half what we did the last time I talked to any of them, but I don't know what it is.
Well, if we set a goal for 5,000,
I think we'll reach it.
I think so too. In my
of course,
meeting,
I think we should work.
I haven't even turned the faucet on. I told them they're going to hear the cry begin to
be glad. We should start.
Do you know if the Presbyterian sent a check? Would you check that for me?